Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does our food say about what we value? And can we experience, and can the experience of eating be enhanced by thinking deeply about how we satisfy our hunger and nourish our bodies? Adam Gopnik is a National Magazine award-winning writer for The New Yorker and has been called a philosopher of food. He shares his thoughts on restaurants, recipes, food ethics, wine writing, and much more in his best-selling book, The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food. It has just been released in paperback. Adam, welcome to Think.
Pleasure to be here, Chris.
You write that even after decades of writing about food, you still struggled with questions about its meaning in modern life. Why is that so much harder to get a handle on than describing taste or texture or smell?
Well, you know, we all know the titillations of the table, right? The things that are delicious, surprising, shocking, and they're wonderful, and trying to describe them is a challenge and a pleasure. But at another level, I think we all want to know, why do we care so much about food, especially now at this moment in history? I think we all can agree that people, privileged people mostly, but really the whole of the country, are kind of obsessed with food in a way that we wouldn't have been 25 or 30 years ago. We have the locavore movement, people who are obsessed with only eating in a food shed of 100 miles. We have the organic movement sweeping the country, Mrs. Obama with her organic garden. We have foodies. We have people who are competitive food eaters. We have a wonderful revival of kind of folk food. You know, wherever I'm in Texas, I'm inundated with barbecue of all kinds and styles. We're not ashamed of that anymore. We're very proud of our local, our regional, our folk taste. So we have this huge food renaissance, but what's it all about, Alfie? That's the question I'm trying to ask in this book. Why do we care so much? What are the values? What are the ideas? What's deeply at stake when we talk about food?
It occurred to me reading this book that food has always been part of our culture, our identity, but now it's become sort of a statement. What we eat becomes a way that we express ourselves.
That's right. It's kind of the simplest symbolic communication that we have. When I was a kid, you know, rock and roll was the simplest symbolic communication we had. You said who you liked best, Joni Mitchell or Bob Dylan, the Stones or the Beatles, and everybody knew who you were. It was a way of declaring who you were because it was the very center of your culture. Now, it seems to me, as I go around the country, food plays that role for a lot of people. You know, if you walk in the door and somebody in a Midwest college gives you an organic carrot sprinkled with fleur de sel and tells you that it was grown by their neighbor in their own yard, you sort of know what their politics are going in. It's kind of easy to guess. Same thing is true. One of the things that's always funny is whenever I'm in Texas, I always get barbecue both from my Republican friends and my Democratic friends, but I always get it treated with in different ways, sometimes with white bread, sometimes with cornbread, and you sort of have to guess at what the political symbolism of that particular thing is. But we use food that way to express who we are. If you're a locavore, you're a person who presents himself as being very much attached to the earth, to tradition, to terroir, against industrialization, against big agribusiness. If you prefer French food to other kinds, you're obviously making a statement, a larger statement than just about your tongue. You're making a statement about kind of which way your whole table, your whole consciousness is oriented. So food has always been a very good way of communicating symbolically. That's why all religions, or most religions, have very strict dietary laws. It's a way of saying, this is who we are. But now, in a much more fluid society, I think we use food more fluidly to say the same kind of thing. This is what I believe. These are what my values are.
There's been all this debate in recent years about French food and French food culture and what it really means when thrown up against the sort of canvas of the rest of the world. You've lived in France for a significant period of time. Talk about what you think separates the way the French approach their eating, their food, as compared with, let's just say, the United States, let alone the rest of the world.
Sure. I think two things. One is an historical thing. One is something that happened in France. France, right around the year 1800, was the first country really in the Western world to have, in plain English, a food scene.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of restaurants. The restaurant is invented in France, in Paris, right around 1780. the kind of restaurant we know today, where you go in with a friend or somebody you're in love with or hope to be in love with, you order from a menu, there's choices, all of those things were invented in France right around 1800. And with it went competitive ways of talking about food. Food criticism is invented at the same time by a bunch of wonderful writers. And for the first time, people are arguing all the time. Which is the better restaurant? What's the right way to make a cassoulet? Who's the most inventive cook? All that kind of talk. And that carried on in France for hundreds of years, and Americans who went to France were kind of inducted into that culture. Julia Child, right, whose 100th anniversary we're celebrating right now, is the ideal example of that. She goes to France during the war. She comes back home and spreads the gospel of French cooking. But as time has gone on, I think Americans and British people and Canadians have gotten frustrated sometimes, exasperated with the dominance of French cooking in that way. Because French cooking also grows out of France. It grows out of a country where there's a lot of protein, there's a lot of cream, there's a lot of butter, and there's a high value placed on technique. French cooking is hard, good French cooking, haute French cooking is hard. So we've seen this reassertion of the Italian tradition as being superior to France. 25 years ago, I suspect, 30 years ago, certainly, the best restaurant in any American city, Cincinnati, New York, Dallas, wherever you went, would be the French restaurant. That would be the place that you would take fancy friends for a fancy meal. And that's been entirely revolutionized now. Now, when I go around America, that kind of old-fashioned French restaurant has largely disappeared, and with it has disappeared the dominance, the spell that French cooking casts, something I have, as a Francophile, I have complicated feelings about.
Yeah, I mean, but are we basically, is it a fool's errand to try and say this is the best cuisine in the world? You're never going to get an objective answer on that.
Oh, absolutely not. The funny thing is that for a very long time, most people who cared about food did answer it that way. They did look to France for leadership. Maybe just in the same way that people in the 19th century looked to Germany for leadership in symphony orchestras, but people did look to France for that leadership. That is over now. I wrote, when I was living in France for many years back in the 90s, I wrote a piece called The Crisis in French Cooking, which was a sort of goodbye to all that piece. It said, you know what, after 200 years of domination, even the French themselves now know that French cooking is not the only kind of great cooking that there is in the world. And it was taken in complicated ways in France. And I think that that's part of our experience of food now, is exactly where at the moment when the hold of French cooking has broken and new things have rushed in to fill its place. Things as odd as cooking from Spain, this molecular cuisine, this high-tech 24-course cooking that I write about in the book and that has begun to become the kind of dominant way of cooking that we have now.
And the idea there is that everything will be very carefully prepared and put in a certain order, but that you will experience not only tastes, but quite literally a series of emotions to go along with those.
That's right. Ferran Adrià, the inventor of molecular cuisine at El Bulli in the north of Spain, says he wants to call it techno-emotional cuisine, and that's exactly it. And I write in the book about going to one of those great techno-emotional restaurants in Spain where they have a whole dessert that's dedicated to Lionel Messi, the great soccer player, where they actually have a little recording of Messi scoring a goal that plays as you eat your way through a series of sugared soccer balls on your way to the explosion of mango mousse that occurs at the exact moment when Messi scores the goal, as your nostrils take in the smell of kind of painted astroturf. You'll have the whole grass and sweetness. You'll experience inside what Messi feels when he scores a goal. Messi, of course, a great player for Barcelona. That's the kind of theatrical. It's much more like a magic show than it is like food. The other thing I'd add, though, Chris, is another thing that makes that kind of revolution in food so revolutionary is that French cooking is all about tradition. It's about continuity. There's innovation in it, but essentially you master a tradition and you show that you've learned a tradition. This kind of cooking, the kind of cooking that's coming to us now from Spain, kind of cooking that goes on in America, is all about innovation. It's all about doing something that's never been done before.
Well, and the chef asserts himself or herself in a different way in that molecular gastronomy, if you want to call it a tradition. It is still relatively new because by its nature, the discussion at the table has to be a lot about the food itself.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things I don't like about it, really. For me, and this is really what The Table Comes First is all about, the joy of eating, and I love to eat and I love to cook, but the joy of eating is the pleasure of the table. It's what goes on around the table rather than what's on the table. Or rather, I guess we could say, it's what on the table ignites among the people around the table. We all know that wonderful moment at a great meal when suddenly the whole table seems to levitate. Conversation has never been so good. Emotions have never been so right. If you're dining with that one person at a great restaurant, romance has never seemed so imminent. There's a kind of a halo around ordinary talk or ordinary feeling that goes on with a great meal. And in one of those molecular meals, it seems to me very often, all of the vectors are pointing at the food, at the plate. And that's a very exhausting experience. It isn't intended to ignite feelings around the table. The feelings around the table are meant to focus on the plate. And I think in many ways that's against the real spirit of cooking. That's against the real purpose, why we have food, why food matters.
And there's also the sort of insider-outsider nature of the whole thing, because God forbid you don't get it.
Absolutely. Oh, no, there's a big snob scene attached to it as well. It's one of the things we laugh at. It's one of the things, sort of the comedy of manners in food now. You know, have you tasted hay? Right now we have gourmet hay for the first time. 7 or 8 kinds of salt presented at every meal. Volcanic salt, black basalt salt. And you know what? It all mostly just tastes like salt. So, yes, of course, this is a huge snob scene attached to it. I guess it's no worse than the snob scene that's attached to, you know, appreciating the blues or classical music or lots of other things. But yes, that's a big part of it. And for me, that takes away from the essential experience of food.
And I think that embrace of the essential experience of food also opens you up to really enjoy the foods that you cook for yourself. When even if you are, and I gather you're quite an accomplished home cook, if you're not a professional, you can still create something that matters to the people you serve it to.
Yeah, I don't know that I'm not an accomplished home cook, but I'm certainly an enthusiastic home cook. You'd have to get reviews from the Gap review from the kids around here. There might be dads, you know, in quotes, tired old cuisine, right, would be going on. I think that's true, though. I think one of the matchless pleasures of life for me, at least, is that moment at 6 o'clock when you start chopping onions and you start assembling a dish, and all of this kind of raw stuff that you've assembled is suddenly becoming something finished, something more complex than the elements you put into it. There's nothing more thrilling than a cake, right? Because if anything demonstrates the way that complexity asserts itself, it's a cake. You start off with the same things, eggs and flour and baking powder and those things, and they become something that has no resemblance to any of its component parts. A chocolate cake is not melted chocolate and eggs. It's a chocolate cake. So there's something sort of thrilling at a very visceral level about the act of cooking. I like to be an inventive cook when I can as well. I tell the story in The Table Comes First of my attempt to make what I call a Bangkok béarnaise sauce using basil and cilantro and mint instead of classic tarragon to make a béarnaise sauce. And I tell the rather shamefaced story that I boasted of having done it before I'd actually done it.
Well, there's nothing like having a phenomenal idea and saying, I'm going to go for it. And when it works, it's amazing. And when it doesn't, it's sort of crushing.
You keep it to yourself. As we say in our family, feed to teddy bear.
Adam Gopnik is with us. He is the National Magazine Award-winning writer for The New Yorker, who is also author of the book, The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food. The book is available now in a paperback edition. We're going to come back to the conversation in about 3 minutes and invite you to get on the line now to join us, perhaps talk about what food means to you, about your own observations. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also reach us via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Adam Gopnik, who writes for The New Yorker and is author of the book The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food. There's a paperback edition available now. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. I want to talk some more about cooking for ourselves, for our families. Like many people, you let us know that you read cookbooks not only for practical recipe advice, but for pleasure. What is the pleasure of reading about a meal you might never prepare or perhaps even ever eat?
I don't know, Chris. It's a mysterious thing. I lie in bed at night, and while my wife turns the pages of fashion magazines thinking about dresses she might someday wear, at least styles she might someday emulate, I turn the pages of cookbooks thinking about meals I almost certainly will never make, or that I know that if I make them will probably be a little bit disappointing. Mm-hmm. It's a habit, I think, of home cooks. I think part of what it is that it's that we recognize in our experience as cooks that there's always this space between the words we read and the things we make. And that's one of the fascinating things about cooking. Remember I was saying a little while ago that one of the great pleasures of cooking is the way that all this stuff somehow becomes a thing that's bigger than any of the stuff that goes into it. And another one of the fascinations of cooking is the way that words and instructions, things you're told to do, sometimes work and sometimes don't and often have to be adjusted. And I think that's part of the fascination. Also, I think that looking forward, planning for the future, is a large part of the pleasure of cooking. I don't know if you feel this way, but when I'm cooking, I very rarely can taste the thing I finally give my guests. I've been tasting through the process of cooking, but when it finally arrives on the plate, I have no appetite for it. You can't really experience it in that way. A lot of cooking is tied up with imagining the future. A lot of cooking is tied up with planning, ambition, and to do a certain kind of thing. So I think the cookbooks kind of play into the pleasure that we feel. I guess also there's another kind of mildly pornographic pleasure in a cookbook, that it's about things that we would love to eat but never actually will, is that kind of deferred pleasure, if you like. And I think all of those things pour into the my own practice, which apparently I share with a lot of people, I'm coming to understand, of turning the pages of cookbooks in bed in a clandestine manner late at night.
It's one thing that I love about my 10-year-old daughter, actually. She goes through cookbooks and she'll put little sticky notes next to the things. Not that she plans to cook. Most of it's above her skill level.
Right.
But it's the stuff that really interests her, and she'll go back and read the same recipes over and over.
Yes, I think that's right. I did that when I was a kid. We had a recipe book for Viennese pastry, and it had Vigo Yanchi slices, which are these amazing kind of chocolate cream cakes. And I would read the recipe over and over and over in the hopes that somehow the words would induce the sensation.
It's also, I think, for many people about the pleasure they give to other people. And it explains why, you know, people who are older and maybe don't have kids in the house or they're living alone, they say they don't want to cook just for themselves. And it always strikes me as something that's not about cutting the portion size down. It's about the fact that it's not as pleasurable simply to cook for oneself.
Absolutely. Life is a table, as I say someplace in the book. And that basic feeling, even though there's always a lot of comedy involved, because you always have one child at the table who sort of is very skilled at pushing things around the plate so they give the illusion of actually eating without actually having to eat the thing they don't, the green thing that they don't care for. And your wife, in my case, is always on a diet, right, and takes two bites and all of that. Nonetheless, that feeling of a thing accomplished, the kind of feeling is somehow very soulful that you've done something and shared it, offered it, is a very profound one. You know, it's one of the most profound things among human beings is the business of sharing food. There's almost not a culture known to anthropology that doesn't make that moment when you first share food with a stranger really hallowed, really significant, really profound. It's very, very hard to kill somebody who you've shared your salt with in that sense. So I think when we're engaged, even on an ordinary Wednesday at 7 in the evening with the business of offering food, we're engaged in something that's very, very primal and deep with human beings.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking to author Adam Gopnik about his new book, The Table Comes First. Let's go on the phones now to Louisville and speak with Angie. Hi, Angie.
Hi. Okay, so I love your show today, and I really just have a comment more than any kind of a question, but your show is really hitting home for me today because when I met my husband, that's what we did. We would get together and we would cook and we would eat, and that's really how our relationship just completely blossomed.
What a great story. Thank you so much for your call.
Don't you, I think everybody, I mean, there are two things I think are true about almost any couple, almost any mildly happy couple. One is that you remember a first date where you went out to eat someplace. It could have been at McDonald's, could have been at a three-star place, but almost always some spark was lit across the table. And the other thing is that you sort of learn over time what your offering food is, what you need to cook for reconciliation, what you need to cook for comfort, what you need to cook for stimulation. My wife loves, I have three different ways of making roast chicken. I do a roast chicken with duck fat, and that's very much our comfort roast chicken. I do a roast chicken with carrots and orange and cumin. That's very much our romantic roast chicken, and I do a kind of Moroccan roast chicken with lots of spices, and that's very much our family roast chicken. So my roast chicken signals the amorous state of the household on any one day.
So there's a little message in what you're making.
There's always a message in food, don't you think? I think that mm-hmm. at any moment, the thing that makes food so interesting and so rich is that it simultaneously feeds an animal appetite and fills a human message, fills a human meaning. That's what makes it so cool.
Talk about this phenomenon you write about of recipe as self-revelation.
Oh, one of the funny things is if you have the habit we've been talking about of reading a lot of recipe books, you see that more and more recipe books are being used as kind of autobiographies by chefs, so that if you read contemporary recipe books, you'll see that they very often have something about the background, the history, the early life of the person involved. There's a wonderful chef here in New York named Michael Salakis, and he writes in his book, which I think is called something like How to Roast a Lamb, about watching his father slaughter a lamb when he was little and the blood spurting from the poor lamb's cut throat, and how that's always part of his experience of eating. I think that that's one of the ways that we use recipes. I try to do it in a, I hope, funny way throughout this book, and writing my own favorite recipes down in the form of imaginary emails to a gourmet from a century ago. I think that that's one of the things that food does. It sums up in kind of epigrammatic form our own experience. It's no accident. In that famous book that Marcel Proust has, the key to all memories, not music, not literature, but the odor of strawberries. I think we use food in that way as a key repository of memory.
We'll talk later in the hour about those imaginary emails that you wrote. But since you brought up the slaughter of the lamb, I want to discuss this. I mean, the ethics of food are so interesting and so complicated today. It would seem that at some point in the not too distant past, the ethics of food were about, sharing if you had food to share, not stealing from others, making sure everybody had enough. And today, because we are globally sourced and we know a lot about our food, there are a lot of questions and decisions to make, even about something as simple and yet as enormous as whether to eat meat or not to eat meat.
Absolutely. And I try to kind of walk around all of those ethical questions in the course of The Table Comes First. In particular, I have a whole chapter devoted to the question of meat or vegetables, whether the rights and wrongs of it. I have a profile of a wonderful cook in England named Fergus Henderson, mm-hmm. who is a carnivore but is the author of the Whole Beast Manifesto. And it's Fergus's view that we only have a right to eat meat if we're prepared to eat the entirety of the animal. That is not just the fillet or the chop, but the hooves and the snout and the cheeks and the brains and the spleen of the pig. That if we're going to make that gesture, we have to eat the entirety of the animal, which seems to me almost conceptually like a form of vegetarianism. It makes so many ethical demands. And I take very seriously the claims of vegetarianism. It's something that comes up steadily in our family, and I try to walk around it. Are we really concerned about slaughtering animals, which we, after all, have raised for food, or is our primary concern ought it to be the pain that animals might feel in the course of their lives? Should we be at ease in our consciences if we're eating animals that have been raised humanely? Or is the very act of killing animals, as an author like Jonathan Safran Foer suggests, is that in itself unethical? In this book, I try not so much to evangelize for particular solutions as to make readers aware of the complexity of the ethical questions that food raises. Or we can ask the locavore question again. Are we really helping the planet when we eat food that's been grown, let's say, within a 100-mile food shed? Or is the truth that it's greener to eat New Zealand lamb than it is to eat New York State lamb? Those are very complicated questions, and they are on our plate all the time now, exactly as you say. We no longer ask so much, do we have enough, as we ask, are we doing this the right way?
Another fascinating thing, Adam, about all of those sorts of questions is that they're not questions that people typically feel are resolved even after they have decided for themselves which way they're going to answer them.
Yes, that's a good point. I think that we feel that we struggle to come to that conclusion. We often backslide or front slide or in some ways. I think there are a lot of people who are in and out, vegans or vegetarians. They're hard questions. The best answer I've been able to come up with to the question of the ethics of meat eating is partly like Fergus Henderson's, to say that if we're going to eat animals, let's eat the totality of the animal. But also to say that I think there's nothing wrong. We all accept that scavenging is a sort of natural act. So that the real concern should be how animals are treated, not whether we slaughter them in order to eat them. What's crucial is that they not suffer, not that they not be raised for food.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Mickey in Addison. Hi, Mickey.
Hi. This is great because I am halfway through The Table Comes First, and I love it. But I was really pleasantly surprised when you mentioned Rudolph Stanish, because back when I was in high school in Dallas in the mid-60s, we had a gourmet club. And I figured out real quick that if I learned how to make omelets, I would be the hit at the party. So I think Mr. Stanish must have had some sort of relationship with Neiman Marcus, because I have, and I bought it back then, a Rudolph Stanish autographed omelet pan.
I should explain quickly. Rudolph Stanish was the king of omelets in the 1960s. He made a reputation for himself as the king of omelets, and I had a dim memory because one of the things I cannot do is a decent omelet. Every amateur cook has a big hole in their ability, and mine. I have several, but one of my biggest is the inability to make an omelet, and I remembered Rudolph Stanish, reading about him in Time magazine when I was a little kid, and you've got an autographed pan. Well, this is a cool thing. Do you use it to cook with?
Here's the question. It's a 10-inch diameter, but it's solid aluminum. And I have been reading, you know, recently that they think that aluminum cooking utensils may have some relationship to Alzheimer's.
That's actually been disproven. To jump in, we've had experts on the show to talk about that.
Oh, hooray, so I can use it. Well, just one other thing I wanted to say. Scrounging around the Half-Price bookstore, we have a great Half-Price bookstore here, I stumbled upon Omelets, Crepes, and Other Recipes, authored by Rudolph Stanish. This is an autographed copy that says Bon Appetit, Rudy Stanish. And in it, he has the classic recipe for an omelet that includes 4 drops of Tabasco.
That's his thing. That's, you know, I mentioned it too. Just quickly, interesting thing is that there are these powerful fashions, as we were talking before, Chris, that fill up food. And it's funny to think about a time when someone who could make an omelet was like a wizard of cuisine, right? That's one thing. The other thing is we have these food things. It's said now that turmeric, the Indian spice, is a very good anti-inflammatory and will hold off Alzheimer's. So all of our food now, my food, has a distinct orange tint as we try to keep our minds alive.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org. Adam, talk for a minute about why you find so much wine writing to be so very tiresome.
Well, there's something sort of what our British friends would call naff, sort of embarrassing and gauche about wine writing. You know, the whole business of you know, it has a grassy nose and yet raspberry tints and a finish. Sort of, I think we all find a little bit embarrassing, partly because it seems like an excess of devotion, but also I think because we all recognize that there's a, you know, I was saying a moment ago that what makes food fascinating is the play between animal appetite and symbolic meaning. And that's true for food, for wine particularly. But there's something about wine writing that does so much about the symbolic meaning, so much about, is it 90 points or 91 points? Or maybe it's just 89 points, and totally eliminates the reality that the first use of wine is for getting drunk. If you read wine writing exclusively, you would have no idea that the reason this stuff was invented was as an intoxicant, was to get you high. Wine writers hate it when I say that because it offends them, because they say, oh, no, we want it as a high-minded experience. And they do. I believe that's true. But the fundamental animal appetite it serves is our appetite for getting drunk. And there's no part of food writing where the animal appetite is as amputated from the symbolic use as it is with wine writing.
Do you think it's a justification of that love of alcohol?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I don't think that wine writers are actually walking around sloshed in every way. Though I will confess that one of my little issues is I like to go to wine tastings, but, you know, in a wine tasting, you're supposed to taste and spit into a common spittoon, right? And I'm one of those squeamish people who just doesn't like to spit into a common spittoon. So I end up drinking my little sips all the way, and I do walk out sloshed from every wine tasting. So maybe that's my own issue. But, no, I don't think they're phonies. I don't think they're phonies at all. I just think that they forget sometimes that the human reality of wine, and when you forget the human reality of wine, you forget the human reality of the happiness that wine brings. Wine is, after all, one of the few things that makes us happy for no reason. Hmm. And that's one of the great joys of it. We feel happy for no reason when we drink it. And I think if you forget that, whenever you forget the human reality, the core of an activity, it becomes a little comical and unreal.
It is interesting. I mean, cheese is starting to come around to this, but there aren't too many other food products that we feel a responsibility to pay as much attention to as we do our wine.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's one of the things, and it is fun. You know, the fine gradations of wine experience are a pleasure. And if you go back in history, it's one of the things I write about. It turns out people have always had a ritual relationship to wine. The oldest wine relics, the oldest wine archaeology that's been done, all involves wine being used in ritual circumstances and so on. So it's wonderful that we use wine in that way for those kinds of tasting rituals, just so long as we don't forget about its first purpose.
Adam Gopnik is with us. He's a National Magazine Award-winning writer for The New Yorker and author of the book The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food. We'll come back to the conversation and take more of your calls and emails in a couple of minutes. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Adam Gopnik. We're talking about his book, The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food. It's available now in paperback. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Adam, tell us about Lizzie Pennell, with whom you had this sort of one-sided imaginary love affair that, as these things are wont to do, ends very badly.
It goes very wrong at the end.
Yeah.
Elizabeth Pennell, a real person, was an American-born, Philadelphia-born woman who went to London and lived very much among the aesthetic circle of Oscar Wilde and Whistler and the rest in the 1890s. And she was one of the first people to write a very literary food column for the Pall Mall Gazette in the 1890s. And she called it The Diary of a Greedy Woman. Isn't that a wonderful title? And she was asserting not that she was a good domestic housekeeper, but that she was a greedy woman with a sensual appetite. And she writes wonderfully about France and French food, about Italian food. She has this wonderful column where she describes this rare exotic thing, spaghetti, and how you ought to eat it and what you ought to put with it. And I got enormously attached to her as I read about her, and I read her her diary of a greedy woman. And it occurred to me that there was something irresistible about it, because here she was 100 years ago writing as a woman who was asserting her right just to eat for pleasure. And here I was as a man, also born in Philadelphia, 100 years later, writing as a man who asserts his right to be in the kitchen and cook. So it was a funny kind of gender reversal going on. So I began writing these emails to her. After all, what else are we going to use to communicate with the dead except emails and energy, the ether? I'm sure they can get them in limbo. And I did it as fun, of course, but I also wanted to try and compare the food world of her time and the food world of our time. And also, I wanted to put a lot of recipes in this book. I have no right to write recipes. I am not a pro cook. But what would be the point of a book about food that was all about people and ideas and wasn't about things themselves, recipes, food itself? So I got to put my recipes in that way. And exactly as you say, Chris, as time went on, I got to know more about her. I became infatuated. And then I discovered at the end that she had one very significant flaw. She was a passionate anti-Semite. As many people were at that time, I might add, she was hardly unique. But she was an anti-Semite, and in particular, her anti-Semitism was directed at my relatives, my ancestors, who were the Jews, the Russian Jews, who had come to Philadelphia around the turn of the century. So it was very personal. And at one moment, I thought, to be honest, Chris, well, I'm going to have to drop her from the book. This whole thing that I thought was a lot of fun is just taking an acid turn now. And then I decided, you know, I wanted this to be a serious book finally. And one of the most serious questions we can ask is, with whom will we eat, with whom will we break bread, and with whom will we not? I said a moment ago, right, that one of the deepest human things is that when we share food, we share experience, and we imply a certain commonality, we imply friendship. Who will we share food with, who would we not? Would I sit down to eat with Elizabeth Pinnell to explain to her why she's wrong? Or would I shun her because she is wrong? Those are very, very deep questions about the meaning of food, and I didn't want finally to avoid them.
You know, when you raise the question that way, it also brings up the issue of class in food and who we eat with. In this country, in a lot of the very best restaurant kitchens in America, there's a lot of Mexican immigrant labor, people who are preparing our meals, doing a fantastic job that a lot of people would not consider worthy dinner companions.
Fascinating you mentioned that. One of my favorite chefs, kind of hero chef of mine, is a guy named David Waltuck, who ran a great restaurant called Chanterelle here in New York. He's now working for a big restaurant firm. And he was talking to me very movingly the other night about the reality that pretty much every cook in every kind of commercial restaurant that he helps supervise is a Mexican, Mexican immigrant, often from the same region of Mexico. And he says it's fascinating to see how some of them sort of take on the challenge, want to learn more, take pride in it. Others see it still as a kind of blue-collar activity. But you're absolutely right that one of the great untold stories about American cooking right now is that it's fundamentally Mexican. It's fundamentally being done in that way by immigrants. And the cheering part of it, if you want to think of it another way, is it shows how infinitely transitive, if you like, food is, because these guys are doing Chinese cooking and French cooking and Mexican cooking and every other kind. But you're absolutely right. There is a deep kind of hidden story of immigration and class in any restaurant you go into in New York right now.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Effie in Frisco. Hi, Effie.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
And first of all, I have an unrelated question, but given the comment that was just made with regards to immigration and food, I know you mentioned Michael Psilakis earlier, and hopefully that's a tale that might kind of inspire how the next evolution of our immigration of food will be, because so much of food, what was food in 20, 30 years ago, has now, we've seen chefs come from that kind of legacy of diner cooks and so forth that now have, you know, Michelin star rated restaurants. So you never know where the next great chef will come from and what lineage they'll have. So that's hopeful, regardless of where you stand on it. But I guess the question that I had with regards to the evolution of food, and you had such great comments about vegetarianism and all the questions and quandaries around it, and how, you know, now more than ever, we're so into where our food comes from. But we also now have, like, there's this topic that has come up among circles, and it's not necessarily the foodie circles, but we also get a lot of comments about food and its form and people having a real issue with eating everything associated, like that gentleman in England, you know, argues we should do. I guess, do you have any thoughts on the bridge between our total thirst and knowledge of knowing everything about where our food comes from and yet our reticence to actually engage and enjoy every part of the food?
I think the two are connected. I think that as people care more and more about where their food comes from, we've all been stuck with the tedious monologue from the waiter who says where everything was sourced right on the that you're going to have on your plate. This came from about 6 miles away from the farm where this thing happened. So on. That can be excessive, but I think we're all turned on by that. We're all interested in that. And at the same time, I think that makes us open, I hope, to more and more kinds of food, more and more parts of the pig that we're prepared to eat if we're still eating pig. And I think that that's a very positive thing, too. It can become churchy. It can become obsessive. One of the themes of The Table Comes First is exactly when are we being obsessive and when are we being serious? That's always something that we have to think about. When we can care too much about our food. Food is not the answer to life's problems, but it is one of the greatest pleasures that life gives us. And you, to my mind at least, what separates us from the animals is exactly that we're capable of thinking about our pleasures, thinking hard about our pleasures. And that, I think, is one of the things that's reflected in our asking questions about where it comes from and what part of the animal it represents.
We have an email here from George who asks that you talk about the relationship between taste and the other senses, particularly sight.
Oh, that's a deep one. I have a whole chapter devoted to the question of taste in this book, which is a bit chewy in parts, I'm sure. But one of the things that's certainly true is that we've learned is that taste is a hugely relative concept. One of the most famous experiments, which those wine tasters we were talking about before hate to hear repeated, but it's true, is that if you black out a glass, so you can't tell if you're drinking red or white wine, even experts have a very hard time telling one from the other. Again, it's not because they're phonies or because they're putting one over on you. It's because the visual clue is a vital part of the sensual experience. And we find that again and again with food. We even have, Chris, we have taste buds in our gut which affect the way that the food in our mouth tastes.
Hmm.
So the experience of taste is never a simple question of the thing on your tongue and how it feels. It's a question of the totality of the room. I was once talking to a great restaurateur, a cook, and he was saying the one thing that pro restaurant people understand that amateurs don't is the taste begins at the door. That is, it's the moment you walk in and how you're greeted. It's the mood you're in when you sit down that crucially affects the taste of everything you have. So visual clues, oral clues, the totality of what's going on, that's all part of taste.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have another email here. This one's from Katie. She wants to know what you think will be the next trend in food cuisine after food trucks and comfort food peaks. What will come later?
Pop up the food truck locavorism. Oh, God, I don't know. I really don't know. I suspect, because I'm watching my own kids, my own teenage kids, that what we've been talking about a lot, moving away from protein on the plate, meat on the plate, as a central part of it, that will happen more and more, and that we'll look back on our habit of having some kind of lump of protein, a steak or a chop or a fillet of fish, as the centerpiece of the meal rather than 16 different kinds of vegetables and grains. I suspect that will look as old-fashioned to us in the future as, beef Wellington looks to us now when we look back.
Of course, this is Texas, and maybe food trucks feel more novel here than they do in New York. But can you talk about that? You can get good things, but it's not necessarily better because it came off a rolling vehicle. What do you think is the appeal of the food truck thing?
The only thought, the only idea I have is that what's now the most valuable thing in our food world? 200 years ago, protein was the most valuable thing, hardest to get, most expensive. What's most valuable now is time, right? Time is so valuable to us. That's one of the reasons why when we go to a fancy meal now, it may take 5 or 6 hours. I'm talking about those molecular meals we've been discussing, because time is the valuable thing. And I think in reverse, we want to eat well, but we want to eat quickly. And we know that conventional fast food is neither good for us nor really good. So we have new ways of making fast food. And then there's the fun of grabbing it off a truck, the informality of it. There's nothing that's more fun than the play between something really terrific and the informality with which it's served. That's, it's one of the joys of barbecue, right, is you eat it off the paper, even though it's one of the great things that you have. If you had barbecue on a ceramic plate, on a French plate, would it be as delicious? I don't think it would be.
Do you think that the speed with which we eat in this country is compared to other places? I think you mentioned in the book that the average French person spends 2 hours a day mm-hmm. at the table on a regular day, not mm-hmm. like a holiday meal.
Right.
Do you think we're cheating ourselves out of something?
Well, look, I have a lot of friends in France. I have a chapter about this bunch of young people who call themselves Le Fooding, of all things.
Right.
And they think that French food is way too slow. They hate the slow food movement. They don't want fast food in the American sense of, badly prepared microwave hamburgers. But they'd love to see French food and French service accelerated a good deal. But no, I don't think, that we do devote enough time. Listen, Chris, I never want to be evangelical about this, only because I understand that most Americans are hugely stressed at every moment of their lives. And it's fine for us to say, a writer like me, you should spend a couple of hours preparing dinner and then eating it. People don't have the time to do mm-hmm. that. Time really is valuable in that way. And in that way, maybe what the truck culture is doing is exactly supplying terrific food for people who don't have that time. I think we need better fast food as much as we need slow food.
Are you conscious of forming food memories as they happen?
Oh, all the time. I mean, I think it's one of the things we want to give our kids, and one of the things, I was lucky enough to live in France for several years. My kids were born and raised there, and it's a source of enormous pleasure to me that they feel very nervous if there's not a baguette on the table. They like to have a bit of French bread with all of their meals. They're not conscious of it. It just is one of the kind of nervous habit that they have, and if there's not a baguette on the table, they're not completely happy. And I will say that I take pleasure in seeing that and thinking, oh, my goodness, that's a little piece of France that's entered into their gut. And sure, you build memories that way. I think when we cook ourselves, when we have a great meal someplace, we say, I wish I could hold this in my mind. And one of the great pleasures of food is, of course, we do hold it in our minds. It's the ultimate key that unlocks our memories is smells and tastes of wonderful things we've had before.
What intrigues you about reading the work of other food writers?
So many things. It's such an odd thing in a way, isn't it, food writing? I mean, here we are using this abstract black and white symbolic system to talk about something that's so concrete, so real in lots of ways. Mm-hmm. I love my favorite food writers. I like all the classics. Liebling, H.A. Liebling is maybe my god in this regard. But I love reading food in fiction, too. It's nothing more wonderful than when you're reading a James Bond novel or a Trollope novel or something, when you suddenly come upon a meal, because authors use meals in lots of different ways, as I try and analyze in the book. Sometimes you share a meal with a character and are meant to. Sometimes Ian McEwan has that wonderful book, Saturday, which is all built around a recipe for bouillabaisse, and he can actually get his recipe. And I think the reason he does that is because one of the meanings of food right now is it's the thing we do when we're thinking about something else, when we use food in that way, the way 19th century people perhaps used walks, where when we're cooking is when our minds, in a sense, are in the most intimate reverie with themselves. And Ian McEwan describes that beautifully. So I love good food in fiction, and I love to follow it and kind of catalog it.
Adam Gopnik's latest book is called The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food. It has just been released in paperback. Adam, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
It's been a pleasure, Chris. Thank you for giving me the time, and thank your callers, too.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs we have planned, and download the free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Any comments, questions, or suggestions, you can send those along to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.